This episode of the Airplane Geeks podcast is brought to you by ComAvia, delivering leading-edge media to the aviation industry. ComAvia, the company the aviation industry turns to for the best in new media marketing communications. Visit them at commmavia.com. Welcome to the Airplane Geeks Podcast. This is episode 283 of the show where we talk aviation. I'm Max Flight, and I'm joined by two co-hosts. First, let's introduce David Vanderhoof from the What Just Flew By blog.
Hey, Max. Hello, everyone. Looking forward to a good show tonight.
Yeah, we've got an interesting guest with an interesting topic. Well, we don't know if the guest is interesting yet, but the topic is interesting, and we'll find out soon if the guest is interesting. I'm sure he is.
Click. I think he just hung up.
Yeah. So also co-hosting, of course, is Rob Mark from the Jetwine blog. Hi, Rob.
Good evening from Chicago. And it is chilly here. Oh, that's right. I'm sorry. We're not supposed to talk about the weather.
That's right.
Sorry.
Our guest this episode is Jack Suhaki. He's president of Eyewitness Animations. Now, they're a forensic animation and courtroom graphics specialist, including aviation accident reconstruction. And I think we first became aware of Eyewitness Animations in connection with the Asiana 214 crash, I think, where we saw some of that animation work. But Jack, welcome to the Airplane Geeks podcast.
Thank you very much. Pleasure to be here. Thank you for inviting me.
Now, we were talking before the show that you've got quite some piloting experience yourself with the airline.
I do. 24 years with Eastern Airlines.
And you flew a couple of interesting aircraft there.
I did. I had the really good fortune to be one of the last pilots to be able to fly big four-engine props for a major airline, that being the Lockheed Constellation. Flew several after that, the Electra and a number of the jets, but the flying the Connie was truly a unique experience.
You know, from time to time, we play a little game called What's Your Favorite Airplane? And between the three of us and our guests, we cover a lot of different ground, but usually my answer is the Constellation. I just think that's about the most beautiful-looking aircraft ever built. So that's cool. It's nice to be talking to someone who's flown one. All right, well, we're going to be talking with Jack about his interesting business in a little bit. First, we've got some aviation news from the past week we'll talk about. And then David has his airplane of the week. David, what are we looking at this time?
The airplane of the week is the Douglas DC-9. I figured since after Delta retired it, our listeners suggested that we should do it. And also, it's kind of a personal favorite of mine, and there's a little bit of story behind that in the history segment.
All right, good. We can't wait for that. We also have an Australia desk report. The guys have some news items from Qantas. Also, an Air India 787 that almost landed at the wrong airport. Yes, sounds like we have another one of those. And something about the new Toowoomba airport. I just like saying Toowoomba.
I thought that was when you needed a dance. You wanted a dance?
It's something like that.
Okay, all right.
In his Across the Pond segment, Peter Johnson talks to our favorite Barcelona Tower air traffic controller, so that's always exciting. And then we'll wrap it up with some of the listener mail that we've received. All right, well, let's get started right away with the aviation news. Is everyone ready?
Ready.
Oh, yeah.
Our first story comes from Air Insight. It's titled, A New Order in Announcing a Further Delay, What It Means for the C-Series. Well, Bombardier announced an order for the C-Series and a delay in entry into service. First, the order, the good news, This is from Al Qahtani Aviation Company. They've ordered 16 firm CS-300 aircraft plus 10 options. And these will be operated by Saudi Gulf Airlines, a newly launched Saudi Arabian airline. And kind of at the same time, Bombardier announced that EIS has moved out to the second half of 2015, and that's from late 2014, originally planned. First with the CS-100, and then the CS-300 follows after that. So it's good news. It's, I don't know if it's unexpected news or not. We know that Bombardier has been a little bit careful about setting dates. They say that it's driven by what they need to do for the test flights. Everybody seems to have delays these days, don't they?
Only if they're building airplanes.
Yeah.
But no, we've seen this coming for a while, I think. I mean, the poor C-Series has been coming and coming and coming. And so I guess the software issue that they're talking about doesn't strike me as that unusual. But again, I think the fact that they have orders, which is something they've desperately wanted, is probably the good side of the bad news.
Yeah, for sure. I think this puts them to a backlog of 198 aircraft, firm aircraft, with options for another 247. So that brings the total to 445 C-Series aircraft, both models, which is, I mean, that's not too shabby. It's not 737 MAX or A320neo kind of territory, but it's still a good start.
Well, sure, but they were never intending to be in that category. I don't think they ever thought they would be, looking thousands of orders in a year or 2 years or anything like that. But my guess is that if we had our C-Series experts around, which those two guys never seem to be around anymore, we'd probably hear that they're pretty close to, feeling better about the C-Series.
Yeah, the president of Bombardier said that there's no major design changes have come out of the test flight program. And they've actually flown the two now aircraft. The second test vehicle had a successful first flight at the beginning of January of this year. So they've got two aircraft flying now. I think just two at this point. And they're doing, what they need to do to test the thing and get it operational. And so we wish them success for sure.
Especially since we have friends that are, I'm sorry. I have a large creature that's joined me here tonight.
Is that Simba the Wonder Dog?
Yeah, Simba the Wonder Dog. And he just pushed me right away from the microphone. But no, I think that everybody's wanted to see this go for some time, and it was kind of shaky. But now they're making everybody a lot more comfortable. And listen, it could be a lot worse. You could be in the boats with the Chinese on their airliners, and that's a place I wouldn't want to be.
Yeah, the Comac and the regional jet that's not moving very quickly either. Yeah, for sure. So we'll watch that, and I think that, well, I don't know. I'd speculate that Bombardier may do a pretty good job of sticking with this round of dates, because I think they waited until they had a pretty good portion of the test program under their belt so that they could give a good forecast for entry into service. All right, we also see a story from Airwise. Abu Dhabi plans aviation biofuel project in the Middle East, of all places. And this is an effort between Etihad Airways, Total, the French energy firm, Boeing, and the Masdar Institute of Science and Technology. And they plan to develop biofuels in the Emirate. Boy, you think of places that might be considering biofuel development. I don't think of the Middle East as my first choice,
They're being proactive, I guess. It seems to me that we're going to need fuel for other reasons. So, I mean, why not? And Emirates has got all sorts of money to play with, and it's just probably another, if they can get ahead of the curve, considering how many airlines are flying in and out of that area, that would be benefits them for profits.
For sure. The Abu Dhabi, according to this article, they want to develop a sustainable energy source as part of an effort to diversify its economy. And that makes a lot of sense to me. They also say that they want to look to biofuels to as a way to help meet the targets, the industry targets for reducing greenhouse gas emissions. So kind of the green angle there. I don't know. You know, Rob is a pilot and Jack is also having been a commercial pilot. Do you guys have any concern over biofuels, or is it just, you know, looks good? Everything's A-okay. The future looks bright for biofuels. I mean, any thoughts on that?
Well, I don't know. Jack, when you were pre-flighting airplanes, if you were checking the fuel, I mean, I guess, of course, the maintenance guys used to usually do that. But can you imagine anything green and slimy coming out of the sump? I mean, that would be a little creepy.
Well, I always would have a concern with growing things in my fuel tank, you know, but yeah. There are still, I think, a lot of reservations in the industry about truly the long-term viability of biofuels. So I think the technology has got a long way to go before, you know, the real final determination of whether it's usable and viable or not will be made.
Yeah, one of the things that, when I read this article, that I first wondered is, what are they going to use in the UAE to produce biofuel? And according to the article, they're looking at agricultural waste, and I don't know if that's from that region or material that would come from other places. Also, date palm leaves. And then this is the one that I thought was most interesting, a saltwater-tolerant plants that could be grown in the Emirates coastal areas. So I thought that was kind of interesting.
I've got an idea. How about if the European countries and the United States sell the Middle Eastern countries all the waste plants they need in order to create biofuel, and we could kind of corner the market on that stuff? And
ooh,
then
yeah,
you know, they could have a waste plant problem.
We could make a cartel.
Waste plant shortage, and then we'd control the market. Oh, well, no, I guess that would be doing the same thing to them, right? So
yeah. So interesting story, and because we haven't heard too much, it seems like we haven't heard too much in the very recent past with biofuels, whereas, I don't know, 12 months ago, there were lots of flights using biofuel or 50-50 mixture most often that we would see.
Well, you know, I'm with Jack on that, because I think that while it is certainly, I'm sure, possible, because they've already proven that these airplanes will fly on whatever this stuff is they're creating, you know, mass producing this kind of fuel and distributing it is no small challenge.
Right. Yeah.
You're talking about completely changing the system that we've had in place for, you know, 50, 60, 70 years. And there may be companies that say, well, you know, that's the part we'll wait for somebody else to develop.
Yeah, that's a good point, Rob, that, I mean, people tend to think of just the manufacturing of the fuel, and in some ways, that's kind of just a very small part of the entire process. You've got to get it to where it's needed, and, you know, have the entire supply pipeline that's built around delivering that particular fuel, and you introduce a different fuel, and it doesn't mean that you have to build an entirely new, you know, pipeline. I don't mean that literally, but so yeah, there's a lot of work to be done, that's for sure. All right, we have an item from the Huffington Post. A WWA Skywhale plane could be the future of air travel. So here's the question. All right, this is a quiz. What airplane is a triple decker that carries 755 passengers, uses advanced materials, a self-healing skin, hybrid electric engines, active wings? Anybody know what that could be?
My ex-wife? No. Oh, God, did I say that? I'm sorry.
It's this Skywhale concept plane. Now, this comes from an aviation enthusiast, Oscar Vinales, I guess maybe is how you pronounce his name. And I think he's done some of these things in the past. But, you know, this kind of a concept plane, he's basically looking at future green aircraft designs and kind of let his imagination run wild, maybe. You know, we probably will never see this. If we could see this, if it was possible, do you think this is a good idea?
It looks good. I think
it looks pretty slick.
I think it looks really cool. Yeah, I like the detachable fuselage, the detachable pod for safety. That if the aircraft starts to crash or something on the ground, the wings break away from the fuselage to protect the people. So it's interesting. Do we really need a 755 person? I mean, how many flight attendants are you going to need for that?
You need an army. But, you know, I mean, I have the same kind of reaction. It's like, this is a huge airplane. Does that even make sense? Is that even something that you'd want to do if you could do? And you know what? I think I said the same thing back when A380s was being developed.
I think they've already proven that the A380 is probably never going to make any money. I mean, because they're never going to sell enough of them.
Yeah, volume's too low.
Yeah, but...
Is like Emirates making money using it?
Well, no, see, that's a different story. Yes. I mean, that's a good point. But there are a limited number of we're going to talk about the DC-9s tonight. I mean, one of the reasons they love those things, I don't know, you know, Jack, the short DC-9s, what, they carry 60 people or something, or 65 or?
Yeah, it was only just something under 70 people, but I know where you're going, and it's exactly right. You can get those into small airports.
Yeah.
One of the biggest problems with the 380 and aircraft like that, there are so few airports around the world that can handle those kinds of aircraft. And that really, really limits its usability, or at least its viability, I think, in a business plan.
Well, I guess the other thing I think about from a business side is, imagine, you know, it happens in bad weather when a flight gets canceled. But can you imagine a flight getting canceled that had 700 tickets on it? Oh my gosh, that's quite a risk for an airline. I mean, it's bad enough with an A380.
Well, not only that, just think about the fact, if you've got something coming across the Atlantic headed for, let's say, New York, and it's wintertime, and one of these superstorms comes in and socks out all of the major airports in the Northeast that could handle a big airplane like that, where in the world do they have to go?
Toronto.
Yeah, or Atlanta, Miami, but, you know, it's not like diverting to Washington because Philadelphia is down to 00. You know, there's some major concerns with flying big airplanes like that.
Yeah, it kind of makes big problems even bigger.
But we don't want to knock the design. I mean, it's an interesting concept. It's nice to see that people are always, you know, kind of pushing the envelope a little bit.
Yeah, we need dreamers. You always need dreamers. And so we'll put the links in the show notes. You know, I encourage folks to go take a look. It is kind of, like David says, pretty interesting concept. And there's a lot of photos, artist renderings, I guess you'd say, of this aircraft that are worth taking a look at. And it's, you know, it's worth thinking about the design approaches that he takes and the things that he's trying to incorporate into the design. And, you know, maybe we will see some of those things in aircraft, other aircraft, more conventional.
Did you notice the design in the graphics that came with it? There weren't any in United colors or Delta or American or even British Airways.
That's right. There was a Qantas, and there was, an Emirates version.
Uh-huh.
It was pretty much the A380's flyer. None of the American airlines have an A380.
Correct.
British Airways, but out of the ones Rob mentioned, but this was the replacement for the A380.
All right. Well, let's push on and talk a little bit about United Airlines. United has got a $2 billion cost-cutting plan. And because their profits last year were a little on the low side, and they believe they have too many flight attendants. So in the Chicago Tribune, we see United to furlough 688 junior flight attendants. Now, United had a voluntary furlough plan, but that was undersubscribed. So they plan to furlough these 688 flight attendants effective April 1st. Big number.
No fooling.
Yeah, I guess that's part of the... still part of the restructuring or the consolidation of the two airlines.
Oh, come on. You know, I guess what really drives me crazy about this is that the Continental side needed flight attendants not that long ago, and now the United side has surplus, and and it's all the same company, or it was supposed to be at this point. And it's just it just seems completely ridiculous to be getting rid of people who are already trained in airplanes and bringing on new people who are not and dumping the people that are trained. Now, what rocket scientist do you figure that came down from?
It seems kind of peculiar, doesn't it?
Peculiar. I think you're being nice.
Well, you know, I like United. I have always liked United.
I have not quite been as quite the United fan that you have, Max.
I realize that.
But, okay, so I noticed that they said, they purposely said junior flight attendant. So these, Rob, these might actually be the recently acquired Continental ones that they're getting rid of. Because, you know, if you listen to any of the flight attendants podcasts, right, the only way to get seniority in United is you have to last about 70 years as a flight attendant. So I'm wondering if it's the same people they brought on and went, oops, we can't afford this, and they're letting those people go.
Well, seniority is seniority. I mean, you're right. I don't know what the dates are, and but you know, I can imagine pilot seniority lists going somewhat the same way, and I'm still waiting to see how this is all going to go down with American and U.S. Air and what's left of America West. God only knows. But you're right. But, you know, again, I just think it's silly to be hiring on one side of the same airline when you're dumping the same kind of people on the other side of the airline. You know, but you're right. There could be details we're not aware of.
All right. Let's talk a little military now. This is from, let's see, what is this? USNI.org. What is that, David?
The United States Naval Institute.
I see. This is heat from F-35 and the MV-22. That's the Osprey, right? Continue yep. to plague big deck amphibs. Well, the F-35B Joint Strike Fighter and the Osprey, they put down a lot of heat, down as in on the landing deck of Navy ships. So, David, this is causing a problem, isn't it?
Well, we're talking about aircraft carriers, but really what we're talking about is LHAs, landing helicraft. They're the amphibious deck, the aircraft that have the ships that have well decks. There are baby carriers. They're the size of most people's aircraft carriers. They're not the super carriers like Nimitz, the Nimitz class or the Ford class. But what they discovered is the F-35B, which is the Marine Corps version, its thrust from its engine to do its vertical takeoff and vertical landings is scorching the decks. And we just have a brand new class of assault ships called the America, which is really supposed to be just a baby flat top, a baby aircraft carrier. It doesn't have the well deck for the landing cushion aircraft. This brand new ship can't support the F-35B. The other part they're discovering is the jet wash that comes out of the V-22, the Osprey, is also scorching the decks. Now, you think you could possibly put some sort of blast effect reflector on the engines for the V-22 when they're pitched up vertically. But the problem with that is the V-22 gets additional thrust from the back of their engines to propel the aircraft forward. So we have two aircraft that are going to be the Navy's and the Marine Corps' assets for the 21st century, and we can't operate them off ships because they're burning the decks off. So it's another, oops, we have some rethinking to do. So the Nimitz-class aircraft carriers are more reinforced, and the F-35C, the straight-wing Navy aircraft, they have the jet blast deflectors. Those are those big walls that come up from the aircraft carrier deck before it's catapulted launched. So they're designed for excess heat and afterburners. So right now, the Navy's got to rethink what it's going to do with its 21st century fighters and how it's going to, and our newest ship in the Navy isn't able to support them. So this is going to be an interesting sidelight to another problem with the F-35 this week, quotes.
And they're not just talking about scorching the deck. They're talking about that heat destroying the metal or altering the metal, I would imagine, at some point, right?
Yes. which is why they weren't going to put the well deck in the America, and they reinforced the deck, but they still haven't reinforced it enough. So we have two more of that, the USS America class, that are currently being built, and they're reinforcing the decks even more. And this is probably a warning going out to the Brits, who are in the process of building their Queen Elizabeth class aircraft carriers. They might have the same problem because they're going to also be using the F-35B.
Wow. Well, in fact, just on a side note, I heard something interesting this weekend that the Brits no longer have an operational aircraft carrier in the Royal Navy. I guess that the next one won't be until this new one is done or something. Is that true, Dave?
That's correct. That when they retired the Invincible class aircraft carriers when they retired their Harriers about 2 years ago now. And so the Royal Navy, for the first time since the 30s, does not have an aircraft carrier or a helicopter carrier. They just have assault ships and capital ships. So the Royal Navy isn't what it's supposed to be, but they will eventually have two of the Queen Elizabeth class aircraft carriers, which will be operating F-35s as well as whatever their helicopter contingent is at the time.
Hmm. Was this a problem that was just missed, or they knew about it and they just sort of chose to figure out a solution later? Do we have any idea?
It's hard to say. It's been reported for a while. What really sort of surprised me was the V-22. I could understand them not anticipating the amount of heat generated from the F-35, but this has been a continuous problem with the Ospreys. And the Ospreys also operate not only from these kind of Harrier carriers, as we like to call them, but they also operate on normal fleet ships where they have a helicopter deck on the back of them. And all of that is going to have to be rethought about because you're going to do continuous ops. And if we're in a war, they're going to be running a lot of continuous ops. That's a lot of damage done to a lot of decks.
Hmm. Wow. All right, one last item quickly. Rob, you had a little piece in Jetwine about a bird strike.
I just thought this was such an interesting piece because for our listeners that may not have seen it, we had a local fellow here in Chicago that owns a Cessna 210 departing just after Christmas from an airport on the southwest side of the city, and he hit a Canada goose just about mid-windshield at 400 feet in the air. And the pictures alone are worth looking at. But what I think is really interesting is that talking with professional pilots about how they would have handled something like that is you get a variety of interesting answers. But this guy was a private pilot. In fact, he's like my wife. He's a psychologist. In fact, that's how I know him. And but he kept his wits about him, despite the fact that the windshield was busted and it got a little loud and there were bird guts everywhere and bits and pieces of the airplane were flying around inside the cabin, and kept his wits about him and flew the airplane and came back around, brought it into land, and everybody was safe. And not. And what's interesting is that neither he nor the passenger got so much as a scratch.
But really?
Yeah, not a scratch. And this goose was 15 pounds because they've got the carcass because it ended up on the floor of the 210. But what I think is really funny is, I'm sorry, and I don't mean funny like it's hilarious, yeah. But this was all captured on video. And when I talked to Keith, I said, well, wow, that's really great. Keith Bard is the pilot. And again, I really wrote about it because I thought it was such a great situation to talk about a pilot who did it all right, as opposed to a little airplane pilot that screwed up. And he had this, what do you call it, a GoPro Hero camera in the back of the cabin.
Oh.
That all this on video. And I thought, wow, isn't that lucky? He said, yeah, you know, he said, I got that as a Christmas present. I just put it in just before we took off. He said, that was my first recording.
Oh, wow.
God. You'll never have anything that exciting again, I hope.
I hope not. Yeah, for sure.
So if anybody hasn't seen it, you have to go over to Jetwine and take a look at this video. It's a short video of and the pictures that were supporting the event. And he's still waiting for his new windshield to show up. The last I talked to him.
Oh dear. All right, we'll put a link to that article in the show notes, as well as all the other news stories we talk about. Okay, again, we're talking with Jack Suhaki. Jack is the president at Eyewitness Animations. Again, Jack, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much. Pleasure to be with you, fellows, this evening.
Now, I think maybe a lot of our listeners may have seen your animations without realizing where they came from on the news or other places, but maybe you can just sort of briefly describe the animations that you create for aviation accidents. So I know there are other kinds of animations or for other non-aviation subjects, but sticking with the aviation for just a little bit, maybe describe what those are like.
Well, I'll tell you, the way I got started in this particular industry was at the waning days of Eastern Airlines, and about the time they were going to be closing their doors in Chapter 13 bankruptcy. The technology in the personal computer industry had gotten to a point where it was possible and actually viable to create animations on personal computers. Before that, there had been a couple attempts to reconstruct aviation accidents, major accidents for both hearings with the NTSB as well as litigation that always follows. But they were done on mainframes, and they were incredibly expensive, meaning millions of dollars. And what I had felt was that there was a real possibility of applying this new, more cost-effective technology to something that has been as complex as reconstructing aviation accidents, both for the purposes of investigation and also for litigation after the fact. And that was really how we started the business. And it was because of my connections with ALPA, the Airline Pilots Association at the time, that really helped launch this as a viable industry. And actually, the first case was in reconstructing an accident in LAX for the Airline Pilots Association.
Well, how did a pilot yourself know about the possibilities of this kind of computer-based animation?
Well, actually, that is a longer story. And it really goes back to the early, mid-1980s when the airline industry was beginning to deregulate. And it didn't take very long for many of us to understand that there were a few carriers, major carriers, like Pan Am, Eastern, TWA, that weren't really effectively positioned in the business world to compete on a level playing field of open competition. And I had begun to consider other ways of making a living. The problem with the airline industry for a pilot is that it's a seniority-based system.
Right.
And you can't, for example, at the end of my period with Eastern Airlines, I was a captain, had been for a number of years, but it took me 15 years in the seniority system to get my fourth stripe. After that, now, I spent 9 years as a captain, checked out on a number of aircraft. But if I were to transition at the closing of Eastern and go to United or American, I would have to start at the very bottom of the seniority list again, probably as a second officer or a very junior first officer, commuting to fly to some base somewhere in the country. And I really didn't want to do that. So I started looking at ways to apply technologies that were out there into another career, and I began a business called American Phoenix that began creating and selling computer graphics systems to engineers and architects using the very first software that was available in the computer-aided design or CAD industry. And by that time, I'd had perhaps 7 or 8 years of computer graphics and desktop computer technology under my belt while I was still flying for Eastern to begin to think about how I might merge my experience and years in aviation with this, I don't want to call it a talent, but the new skill that I've been developing in computer graphics and technology. and really eventually just began to think about the complexity of an aviation accident and how difficult that is for someone who's not intimately involved or familiar with all the different aspects that go into these investigations, to put some sense to them, to understand how they occurred, what had occurred, and what combination of events came together to create an accident, because usually it's not just one element.
Sure.
And that was really the genesis of it, and decided to then take that background in aviation, the background I'd then developed in the computer graphics industry, meld them together, and begin looking at how we could effectively and affordably start reconstructing these events so that not just members of a board like the NTSB, but members on a jury could also understand more clearly what it is that may have led to the tragic event and some of these accidents.
Now, these animations are, well, they're fairly accurate, aren't they? I mean, they're not just a, you know, a cartoon that sort of gives you a rough idea of kind of what happened. They're based on data in order to be accurate representations.
Yes, they are. As a matter of fact, you mentioned the Asiana 214 crash and the animation we had done for that particular event. And I should say, we didn't do that for a client. What had prompted me to have my people put that together was the frustration of watching these amateurish reconstructions that we see on TV all the time following a major accident. And every time you look at these things, they'll take a segment of flight that may perhaps in real time be 45 seconds to a minute long, and they'll compress it down to a 5 or 10 second clip, and it's totally unrealistic. And there was some basic information coming out from the press conferences held by the NTSB on specific data from that flight data recorders coming off of the aircraft. And there was also a couple videos, eyewitness videos that were available that could be analyzed. And there was enough really to put together a fairly reasonable reconstruction of what that accident really looked like. And that was actually the reason we had put it together, and then we just released it to the media here in Southern California.
Did you use any of the FlightAware technology in your work on that one, Jack?
No, we didn't. And I'll tell you why. We purposely stay away from that because there's a licensing issue and accuracy concerns that we don't – I have a great deal of confidence in what FlightAware comes out with. But that being said, it is safer to go with a presentation made on TV at a press conference by an NTSB official than using their data from FlightAware. Uh-huh. So what we try to make sure is that there's some substance and basis to everything that we put into these animations. And a concern with FlightAware is if they're not brought in as a participant to something like this early on, there's no way to verify that their data is actually accurate, although I'm quite sure it is. But we did not rely on it.
Interesting.
Well, I remember at the time of the Asiana crash, there was some video, really not very good video,
yes,
of the accident. And it was, you know, kind of hard to see exactly what happened. And I remember some people were describing, some press reports were describing the aircraft as cartwheeling. And I watched the video, and it didn't look like that was a cartwheel to me at all. But then when I saw your video from Eyewitness Animations, it really kind of gave a quite clear picture of what had happened.
Yeah, I'll tell you what, we have done this on a number of occasions in the past, generally with general aviation accidents, because that is typically where we might see some video footage taken by an eyewitness or security camera footage off of a building. And what we've been able to do is we'll have enough factual information in the case of Asiana from the statements made by the NTSB, speed, times, impacts. And we knew, after a little research, where that eyewitness was standing along the shoreline that had taken that video with their, I guess it was like an iPhone or phone camera of some sort. And by lining up that position with different landmarks or things that you could identify on the airport property, we could very accurately determine exactly where the aircraft was. And if we take the video and we begin to analyze it one frame at a time, and if it's taken at the standard 30 frames per second, we can then match every 30th of a second the position of an aircraft. And we'll take our model that we'll construct to being extremely accurate to the dimensions of the real aircraft. We'll then superimpose that as in front of the video, which we'd use as a background, have it scaled to the correct distance from the point of the videographer to where the aircraft was. And then we can match the aircraft frame by frame by frame with the model. And in the end, you find you end up with a very relatively accurate depiction of the actual actions of the aircraft during that final seconds of the crash. Now, what we'll find is undoubtedly we're going to be involved in the litigation as that begins to unfold here shortly, and we'll have access to the flight data recorder. And I have little doubt but that when we take the flight data recorder information, we'll find that it deflects very, very slightly from what we've already put into our preliminary reconstruction.
In the case of litigation, how do you come in? Do you come in as a neutral party, or are you retained by one side or the other? How does that work in court?
If it's litigation, I'll be retained by one party in the litigation, either as a defense or a plaintiff witness. And as an expert, in the eyes of the court, we must be objective. And in order to put together a presentation like this for a trial, it's necessary to have some underlying data upon which we can base the animation. And an aviation crash, it's, believe it or not, it's much simpler than something as simple as you might think, an automobile accident or a slip and fall accident. With an aviation accident, we have so much data that's verifiable. For example, the flight data recorder, cockpit voice recorders, communications between ATC towers and the cockpit, radar, FAA radar, Doppler weather, MEDARs. All of this information can come together in such a way that allows us to take these different elements, incorporate them into the animation, and it becomes a very, very accurate reconstruction of the actual event and how it happened. And in most cases, cockpit voice recorders, we'll synchronize the conversations and the communications with the animation itself. And these can become frighteningly real. It's really amazing the effect that they have on a jury. It also kind of points out the importance of them being accurate because they are so effective.
Right. So you're not trying to, support either side in the case of litigation. You're trying to show what happened. You're trying to be factual.
Yes, exactly. I mean, we can't make a purse out of a pig's ear. And we make that very clear to our clients or potential clients right from the beginning. And, it's very important that they understand that we will reconstruct an event based on the facts and the evidence. Now, there are pieces of evidence and opinions that come into a lot of these cases that you can't find factual documentation or a basis for them, and that's where aviation accident reconstructionists play a role. And they may actually form an opinion. I'll give you an example. We do a number of general aviation accident reconstructions where we don't have all the sophisticated data that you might find on an airliner. And we do have physical evidence from the materials that they find on the ground post-impact. We have certain radar data. But as you know, radar data is only good down to about 200 feet above the ground. Below that, you don't really know what's happening. So what might happen is that we'll have an expert involved who is an airframe expert who will testify to the fact that it is his belief that due to certain structural pressures, a flight surface of the aircraft failed due to, let's say, a harmonic vibration, and it came off thusly. And this part of the left wing broke loose, struck the left horizontal stabilizer, and led to one failure after another. So in that case, we don't know that. We don't really have any factual information, but we will rely upon the credibility and the opinion of that expert, and will then create what's really a visualization of their opinions in a case. So now those people have to first go to the court, or they will appear in court and under oath be sworn in as expert witnesses and have to convince the court that they are indeed experts and qualified to express an opinion in their field of expertise. And then that sets the platform for us to say, well, we use their opinions, their findings, and their data to include in our animation those aspects that were reflected in physical evidence, ATC communications, radar, that sort of thing.
Did you happen to do the Colgan accident, Jack?
No. We were retained in it, but we never did any work on it. You're talking about the one in Buffalo, correct?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, no. That turned out to be such, for Colgan anyway, such an embarrassing evident accident that I don't think very much of any of that went to litigation. It was all settled, or most of it was.
Jack, one thing that we've mentioned many times is the pressures, let's say, that are put on journalists, bloggers, folks like that, after an accident or some kind of an incident that becomes a news story. There's a lot of pressure to get something published as quickly as possible. And sometimes yes. That has a negative impact on the on the quality of the journalism or the reporting that's been done.
Quality? You mean the accuracy?
Accuracy, yes. Well, that's part of the quality. But yeah, Jack, do you find yourself coming under pressures like that?
Well, we do, and you know what you're stating is absolutely true, and especially in the news industry where yesterday's events are ancient history and nobody even really wants to talk about it. But we often will get, and we did in Asiana, requests from the networks to put together a quick and dirty animation for them that they could use by the latest the very next morning. And I refuse to do that because there's no way you can do it justice with that little information available. And we told them that, you know, we would put one together, but that we would have to wait till at least some preliminary information came out. And then it took us, now I'm talking about four people working on this, animators and artists, it took four full days to produce that animation segment.
Yeah, I was going to ask you about the resources that get devoted to creating one of these.
Yeah, you know, and that's something, those sorts of resources aren't something that the networks are willing to spend any longer. Now, we did in the early days, no one else did this, including the networks, and we did these reconstructions for all the major networks every time there was a train, aviation accident, or so on. And it took much longer to produce them in those days. I'm talking 21 years ago now. But you know, the problem was that you couldn't get a decent reconstruction out for a few days until after an accident. And in the news world, boy, that's really ancient history. Nobody wants to, you know, talk about it unless it's something spectacular. You know, Asiana is quite different than most accidents that happened. It was one of these miraculous types of major aviation accident that resulted in only a few people losing their lives as opposed to the possibility of a couple hundred people dying on that airplane, or close to a couple hundred. And it brought up a lot of issues like foreign carriers being allowed rights to fly into the states when the U.S. doesn't have any control over their training. And then immediately was the, how in the world does an airliner as sophisticated and new as the 777 crash on a clear, sparkling day in sunshine in San Francisco? So there were a lot of elements that made that crash unique and different than most others we've seen for quite a number of years.
You know, something I'm curious, you mentioned 214, Jack. And now when you did that animation, who paid you for that? Did the networks pay you for that?
No one paid us for that. I got to the point of being so frustrated and so upset with seeing poorly done reconstructions on TV about these accidents when they happen that I put everyone to work. We fortunately had a break between projects that I could take the my animators off and put them onto this one. And just was tired of seeing this stuff, and I wanted to put something out there that was accurate, at least as accurate as it could be, considering the information that was available. So, you know, in the end, no, we never did get paid for that. We may be involved in it later on. But interestingly enough now, everything that we have done that went into the production of that animation has to be thrown out if we are retained and we need to reconstruct it for litigation, simply because everything we based it on would have to be thrown out. We can't just use NTSB reports given on, you know, on the national news as a briefing. We'll have to actually rely on the flight data recorder information, the cockpit voice recorder, and that sort of thing.
That's really interesting.
Yeah, this is fascinating stuff. And you've been doing it for a long time. I see that Eyewitness Animations was originally formed, what, back in 1989?
Yeah, the corporation was. And I'll tell you what, it's really interesting. This, when I started this, I wasn't really sure that there was even a market to do this, whether there was a viability in producing these. I thought there was, but there was no business model for it. No one was doing this in the industry. And I think there were perhaps two other engineers that had decided to do similar reconstructions about the same time on other accidents. And I got involved with, I'm trying to think of the name of the flight. It was U.S. Airways. I think it was 1493. It was a 737 U.S. Airways flight from...
One?
I'm sorry?
The Pittsburgh one?
Yes. Well, yep. No. I don't know if it was from Pittsburgh, but it landed, was going to L.A. Is that the one you're thinking of? Or?
Oh, I'm no, I'm sorry.
Okay, you're thinking of the one that where the tail came off. No, this is, yeah.
Shut up.
This one, they were coming in to land at LAX on 24 left. And as I recall, the 737 was still on approach control. And it was a clear night. And the ground controller had a Metro 3, I think it was a SkyWest Metro 3 commuter that wanted an intersection takeoff because that runway is so long. You know, you can take off and land three times in a metro liner. And the tower controller cleared the metro liner into position and hold some way halfway down the runway. Now, this is at night. Keep this in mind. And that happened before the U.S. air flight was switched from approach control to the tower. So subsequent now to the Metro being put on a runway and told to hold, U.S. Airways came onto the tower frequency and said they had the runway in sight, et cetera, et cetera. And the controller now forgot about the Metro liner being on a runway and said, Roger, U.S. Air, clear to land. And oddly enough, the Metro liner was blocking out one of the white centerline lights on a runway. And when it was sitting on the position that it was occupying, its white navigation taillight occupied that general position. And we thought when we started this project that you might not even see that there was a break in the light centerline lights along the runway at night.
Interesting.
And so we were doing this now for the Airline Pilots Association. So we did have access to the flight data recorder information and all the other stuff that was part of the FAA package. And when we took a very close look at the Metro liner, we noticed that the red rotating beacon was located in the upper front leading edge of the vertical stabilizer. And if you were within a very narrow zone, if you can think of a little triangle extending back from the back end of the aircraft, you can't see either the red or green wingtip navigation lights or the red rotating beacon. The only light you can see on that airplane is the white tail light that doesn't flash on that airplane and just simply blended right in with the other centerline lights. So U.S. Air goes and touches down. As they're rolling out, they just crash into the back of the Metro liner, killed everyone on a Metro liner. The captain died on the 737 when it came to rest against the fire station. And no one could understand yet how that happened. So when we put the animation together, we had the specifications from Boeing on the landing light, pattern and that sort of thing. We took the flight data recorder information, so we knew exactly what the orientation was of the 737 all the way down to touchdown, when the nose came down, and so on. And what we saw, interestingly enough, in the model, after we had done the animation, was as the nose of the 737 is coming down, it would illuminate the back of the props on the Metroliner. And the Metroliner is a very narrow fuselage aircraft. So we put this together and brought the crew in to look at it, the co-pilot. And he said that was exactly what they'd seen that night. They had no clue at all that there was an aircraft on the runway until the landing lights of the Boeing lit up the back of the props. And then he said he couldn't figure out what they were, because it just didn't make logical sense that he saw these two discs sitting in front of them. And that was actually, to me, the Yahoo moment that told me that there really was an opportunity to use these applications or these animations and put them into some sort of a useful marketplace, helping both in investigations and then in litigation. So, long story, but that was the determining point in the history of this company.
Now, do you work with companies outside of the U.S. as well, Jack?
On occasion, but not typically. We usually are working just the litigation systems in other nations are quite different. And as far as investigations, they usually have their own agencies, and there's a lot of politicking going on in that. So we don't typically get involved in it. We have on occasion represented aircraft manufacturers in litigation to put together something that they would later use in their efforts to place forward as an argument in an accident that happened overseas.
Mm-hmm. Well, we need to push on, Jack, but one thing I wanted to ask you is this. I mean, my observation after listening to you describe this is that doing something like this well really requires someone like yourself who has a lot of experience, a lot of direct experience. So I'm curious to know what are the backgrounds of the other employees in Eyewitness Animation? What are they like?
Well, you've really described quite accurately the dilemma that I have in running this business and carrying forward, is getting people who both have a knowledge of aviation, at least to some degree, and also are quite expert in three-dimensional modeling and animation. And typically, there aren't very many of those people around. So what it requires is a great deal of oversight and very specific instructions. And if you can imagine, I really architect all of these animations. We do a large spreadsheet in which I will depict graphically, not drawing aircraft and that, but on a line, on a graph, when something takes place, at what time it takes place, to what degree a change may occur, whether it's a roll of an aircraft or a pitch up of the nose, precisely what frame that begins, what the rate of nose up pitch will be, when it ends. So there's a lot of direction that goes into putting these things together and finally getting them to the animators to where they can utilize them. So that has been really one of the reasons that there are so few of us really doing aviation-based animation work. It really, really seriously does take someone with some serious experience in aviation, or aeronautics at least, to do this.
Wow. What an interesting business. All right, Jack, thank you so much for taking the time to explain this to us. Where can folks find more about Eyewitness Animations online?
We have a website, and it is simply eyewitnessanimations.com. That's plural. And eyewitness is with an E, not an I, as so many people seem to want to spell. There was years ago, there was a TV show called Eyewitness Video. And somehow that has just been burned into memories of people for generations now, that when you say eyewitness, half of the people will spell it with an I. But eyewitnessanimations.com.
Thanks, Jack. And listen, don't even think about trying to do any kind of an eyewitness animation of the Airplane Geeks crew doing the show.
I've been taking notes.
No, it was really interesting. It really was.
Yeah, watch NBC here in about a week.
Yeah, great.
We'll do it. Thank you, guys. Appreciate it.
And now with his aircraft of the week, here's David Vanderhoof, our official Airplane Geeks historian.
Thanks, Max. Truth be told, I am partial to this week's aircraft of the week. A picture of a Delta DC-930 has been in my room since I was two, and it's still in my den and hanging over me as I record. My dad was going to Maxwell Air Force Base for school, as he would call it. Needless to say, I don't remember my first flight other than it was commemorated by that print that hangs in my room. The DC-8, while not a feeder, as its Boeing competitor, was making Douglas money. Douglas foresaw the need for a feeder aircraft that could fly to the larger airports which supported the DC-8. Initially, Douglas signed a two-year agreement to support and then produce the Sud Aviation Caravelle. The contract expired with no Caravelles ordered. Douglas then created a clean sheet aircraft. Boeing was working simultaneously on the 727. It chose to use components from the 707 to speed up the development of the trijet. The 1962 study carried 63 passengers with a gross weight of 69,000 pounds and was very different from the DC-8. The design featured a fuselage-mounted engines, a lesson learned from the Caravelle. The power plant would be the Pratt & Whitney.
Yay!
The JT-8D turbofan engines. It was based on the J-52, which powered the Grumman A-6 Intruder, and another Douglas design, the A-4 Skyhawk. Thus, when a DC-9 takes off, it's like a section of Skyhawks as far as noise is concerned, and as most people know, I'm partial to that sound. The DC-9 used efficient small wings, 89.4 feet long. The flaps were almost a complete span. This lowered the takeoff and landing speeds and therefore reduced the necessary field length. The lack of potted engines under the wings gave the DC-9 a lower ground clearance. This made loading and offloading baggage and passengers easier. The aircraft could also be equipped with built-in air stairs. The simplicity helped maintain aircraft fly out of smaller airports. The lower ground clearance also meant that it was easier to maintain. The fuselage is a single aisle, two-side, three-seat arrangement, with the original Series 10 aircraft having a fuselage length of 104 feet. The most radical part of the DC-9 was its T-tail. Douglas began production on April 8, 1963. Not quite 2 years later, the prototype DC-9 flew on February 25, 1965 out of Douglas's Long Beach, California plant. By July 1965, a test fleet of five aircraft were flying and with working on the FAA certification. The Dash 10 received its airworthiness certificate November 23, 1965, with Delta Airlines. Its launch culture entering it into service on December 8th. In total, that was 975 days or 2.67 years from paper to revenue. We clearly just don't work that way anymore. Why is that? I have no clue. But the A350 XWB was announced in 2006, just flew in 2013, and won't enter service into the fourth quarter of 2014, maybe. Not sure what happened to this industry, but my rant is over about that. Eventually, 137 of the Series 10 would be produced. Production ended in 1968. By 1966, it was clear that Douglas had a hit. To counter the Boeing 737, Douglas created the Series 30. The 30 had a 14-foot, 9-inch fuselage extension. The 30 first flew on August 1st, 1966, and Eastern Airlines, cheer here, took delivery of the first the following February. The 30 had a revised wing that was 3 feet longer. It also had a 6% increase in chord. To assist in higher landing weights, full-span slats were added to the leading edge. The 30 could carry as many as 115 passengers all in one class. The Series 30 came in four versions. The 31, which was an all-passenger version. The 32, which increased the weight to 110,000 pounds. The 32 was also used for freighters. There was three types. the 32LWF, which featured a strip cabin, no reinforced floor or cargo door, the 32CF, or convertible freighter, with a reinforced floor but could also have passenger equipment loaded in it, and lastly, the 32AF, all freighter, with no windows and all just strictly cargo with a reinforced floor. The Dash 33 was introduced in 1968. It had an increased wing incidence of 1.25 degrees and thus reduced the drag. The Dash 34 also came with the increased wing incidence, and the 33 was intended to be for long-range operations. In all, 621 of the 30 series were produced, with 63% of the total production. The Series 20 came after the 30. The Scandinavian Airline System, or SAS, ordered 10 of the Series 20. Designed for ultra-short field performance, the fuselage of the 10 was combined with the longer wing of the 30. The Series 20 had less fuel capacity than the 10. The fuel reduction was to help performance. SAS also was influential in creating the Series 40, and that was issued on March 1968. The Series 30 was stretched again by 6 feet 6 inches to increase the passenger load to 125. This was 10 more passengers than the Series 30. The Series 50 again was stretched 8 feet 2 inches and carried up to 139 passengers. The length also forced the addition of strakes below the cockpit for stability. Eastern Airlines entered it in service in 1975. In the fall of 1966, the United States Air Force issued a request for proposals under CX-2. The CX-2 requirements were for a jet to operate in all climates, have a speed of 0.75 Mach, and with a range of 200 nautical miles. It also had to carry either 40 ambulatory or 30 litter patients in a mixed combination of both. August 1967, an order for 8 C-98s were awarded to then McDonnell Douglas. The DC-930 beat out the 737 and the BAC-111. June 1968, the first C-9A was rolled out of the Long Beach plant. The C-9A was then given the name Nightingale, after Florence Nightingale, the nurse from the Crimean War. Eventually, 23 C-9As would be built and flown until their retirement in 2005. The United States Navy would purchase 24 C-9B Skytrain 2s. Skytrain was the name of the Douglas R-4D, or C-47, in Navy service. The C-9B was equipped with a cargo door and a convertible for car, and was convertible for cargo and or passengers. The C-9B was also fitted with supplemental fuel tanks in the baggage area to improve range. The Fleet Support Squadrons Groups, or VRs, continue to fly the C-9 today. In the late 1980s, the U.S. Navy purchased 5 more off-the-shelf used DC-9s. They were called C-9Cs. In 1975, McDonnell Douglas delivered 3 VC-9Cs. These were configured for VIP operations. The VC-9C supplemented the then VC-135s and provided support for the vice president and VIPs until all 3 were retired in 2011. With the vice president aboard, it's Air Force 2. However, for short hauls, they have been known to fly with the call sign Air Force 1, carrying Clinton, Bush, and Reagan. The 3 VC-9Cs were painted in Raymond Loy's scheme commissioned by Jackie Kennedy, the beautiful blue, blue, and polished silver. However, probably the most famous VIP DC-932 was November 950 Papa Bravo. It was all black with a white Playboy bunny on the tail. Hugh Effort owned the aircraft and paid $9 million for, as it was called, Air Force One. It was eventually sold to Aeromexico and fitted as a straight airliner and flown to 2004. So that's the way it was. This is David M. Vanderhoof talking about his very first flight in the DC-9. Until next week.
Wow. Rob, do you think next time we ought to ask David to provide a little more detail?
I was kind of hoping that there would be links to bunny pictures to, you know, kind of integrate with the black DC-9 from Hef.
Wow, David, that was massive.
Yeah.
Considering I didn't touch the McDonnell Douglas and the Boeing product.
Wow. Very good. Thanks a lot, David.
You know, I flew that airplane for 5 years, and I didn't know anywhere near that.
I'm sure. I'm sure.
You didn't need to. You just needed to know which lever to pull.
That's right.
And when.
The didgeridoo means it's time for the Australian News Desk. Here's two of the craziest guys we could find south of the equator. It's Steve Vischer and Grant McHaren from the Plain Crazy Down Under podcast.
Dateline, 19th of January, 2014.
Well, good day, folks, and welcome to the Australia Desk for episode 283. I am obviously not Steve Vischer. It's ATC Ben, and as always, joining us in the studio and running the ragtag bunch of Steve Vischer replacements is Grant McCarran. How you going?
Hey, not bad, mate. I'm also not Steve Vischer, and also not Steve Vischer is Jonesy, Ben Jones. Welcome to another AusDesk.
G'day, Grant. G'day, Ben. And yes, I'm not Steve Vischer.
Also not Steve Vischer, we have yet another. Not Steve Vischer. Damien Rose, this is your first time in a while that you've been on an AusDesk, isn't it?
It's my first time ever, Grant, that I've been on an AusDesk.
So we've got ATC Ben, Jonesy, Damo, and myself. We're here, we're ready to go, and we've got a few stories lined up. So let's do an AusDesk. And guys, let's start off with Qantas being fined $90,000 in the US for not telling passengers on a delayed, then subsequently cancelled, Dallas-Fort Worth to Brisbane flight that they could deplane if they wanted to.
Apparently, it's a U.S. Department of Transport requirement, part of the three-hour tarmac rule, that 30 minutes after the scheduled departure time of the aircraft, you have to tell the passengers that they can actually deplane the aircraft should they wish to, and they have to repeat that every 30 minutes. Qantas didn't do that, and this aircraft was delayed for 5 hours before they finally pulled the pin and cancelled the flight.
Yeah, it looks like it left the gate, came back to the gate, left the gate, came back to the gate. Apparently, somebody was reporting some issues with a de-icing valve.
The comment of the possible de-icing valve issue didn't actually come from the Telegraph Travel article itself, but was more in line with the comments on the section from somebody reporting to actually be on their flight. I don't know how much emphasis you can put on that and whether they were really actually on the flight, but it is a potential issue that they might have had.
Yeah, it's interesting going back and forth, regardless of whether it was the de-icing valve or not. And yeah, you're right, Jonesy, that was in the comments. But yeah, obviously a bit of maintenance and mechanical issues there, especially if they subsequently scrub the flight. Well, speaking of people stuck, there's people running around saying that they reckon Qantas is stuck with its decision to remove 737s and mainline service from Hobart, the capital of the state of Tasmania, right at the bottom of Australia, and replacing it with the QantasLink so-called regional aircraft, using the Boeing 717.
Yeah, Grant, it's actually back to the future with this decision. Those who can remember back to when Qantas originally got these 717s and branded them in the QantasLink brand when they bought Impulse back in the day, 717s were always down in Tasmania doing those runs for Qantas anyway, until they eventually became part of Jetstar and launched that operation, and then they got transferred out to the west to help with the mining operation as QantasLink once again.
Yes, and unfortunately, tomorrow morning at about 5 o'clock, I'll be boarding one of those old 717s with no in-flight entertainment and no radio. How that sucks.
Lovely. But hey, at least the folks down at Tasmania and Hobart are probably going to get the same ones that are being used on that other second-rate capital, referred to as Canberra, where they are also now using 717s, but their ones have a business class and lots of in-flight entertainment, I'm told.
Look after the people that don't really earn the country all the money. That's all I've got to say on the matter.
The 717s on the East Coast have been upgraded to actually have business class. The ones in the West don't. The Canberra services were actually upgraded from Q400s. It's a bit different for them, but the Canberra-Brisbane and a lot of the Canberra-Melbourne flying is now 717-200s, so they're making a bit of a comeback in Australia.
Do you guys know any passenger numbers that they're carrying currently weekly, or is a downgrade to the 717 going to put on extra flights to cater for the load, or is it just a diminished load?
I think they are talking about extra flights, probably one extra sector a day. And one of them will be an upgrade from a Q400.
So there is obviously still a need for the amount of passengers to be transported in.
I think it's more of a correct aircraft for the job thing.
Well, there is that. I mean, especially going from Hobart to Adelaide or Hobart to Melbourne, it's a pretty short run. And if you don't have a lot of passengers there, then you're flying a 737 relatively empty. I think that's why they've been shifting to the 717 on the runs to Canberra as well. I mean, they still do have some 737s flying there. But yeah, if the numbers aren't there, it's sort of like Virgin using the E190. 80s. I've been on an E190 between Melbourne and Sydney because, hey, there just weren't enough passengers to make it worthwhile putting a 73 on it.
It says here in this article in The Australian that a spokesman at Qantas says that the change is about making sure they put the right aircraft on the right routes in support of leisure and business travel. So I guess that's the line that they're taking.
Speaking of the right aircraft in the right place, we had a situation where an Air India 787 coming out of Sydney joined the list of those that have. They wound up lining up on Essendon Airport instead of Melbourne International. So they were basically lining up on our executive Big End GA airport, which is a little bit shorter on the runway, isn't it?
There's quite a significant difference between the two. The runway that they were supposed to land on, and did eventually land on once they made a little dog leg to correct themselves, was runway 34 at Melbourne, which is 3,657 metres long. That's just a couple of feet under 12,000 feet. Essendon's runway 35 is only 1,504 metres or 4,934 feet. So it would have been quite a hard stop.
Would have been a rude shock for them.
Definitely would have been a brake change in there somewhere, and maybe a couple of tyres, I'd say.
And the velour on the pilot seats. But don't forget, guys, that when you approach from the south, heading up that main runway of Essendon, at the other end, it does sort of go into a ravine.
If you didn't pull up by the end of the runway, it's definitely gets very interesting if you go off the end of runway 35 at Essendon. As they have done before, there is, I believe, a 747 and a DC-10 of certain Asian carriers who shall remain unnamed have also made this little mistake. Melbourne Approach Controller was on the ball and sort of asked him if he actually had runway 34 at Melbourne in sight with the strobes. We have three strobe lights that lead into the runway for 34 to try and prevent this kind of thing. The Air India pilots realised their mistake and corrected themselves, which avoided them joining the list of wrong airport arrivals.
What is it, about 4 or 5 miles between the two runways?
They're just under 5 miles between the two airports.
I really don't know how this is happening with the last, you know, 5 incidents in the last 6 months. These aircraft have things called EFISs and flight management computers and systems, and okay, fair enough if they're coming in and they're doing a visual approach.
So I'm with Jonesy that I'm surprised that the 787, which is the latest and greatest, has some of the biggest glass screens I've ever seen in a cockpit ever. I think they're probably just as big as the ones I'm looking at now on my desk. They didn't realise that the little magenta line didn't go to the airport that they were looking at.
Guys, we're out of time. Damo, it's been great having you here.
Oh, my pleasure. Thanks for having me in.
No worries. And Jonesy, mate, thanks for kibbutzing in there from WA. Hope we haven't kept you getting too warm with the ceiling fan turned off.
No, it's been absolutely stinking over here in Perth, but it's starting to cool down.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. We had our 40 plus for 3 or 4 days here, and then the southerly change came in and we dropped 25 degrees in 2 hours.
Holy cow.
It might be hot here, but I'm flying off into the desert tomorrow morning, so I'm going to be really excited about that.
At least it's a dry heat, mate.
I'll tell you what, at lunchtime tomorrow, Jonesy, I'll drive 2 blocks down and go have lunch on the beach for you.
Excellent. Thank you.
And cackling away there, ATC Ben, mate, thanks very much for joining in.
No, thanks. Thanks for having us back again. And for our American listeners, yeah, we had 3 or 4 days of triple digits, and it's forecast to go back towards that way at the end of next week. So we're going to brace for a second week of summer.
And hopefully next week we might be able to get some normality back into the Australia desk and have Steve Vischer back with us. Until then, I'm Grant McCarran.
I'm ATC Ben.
I'm apparently not normal, but my name's Damien Rose.
And I'm Ben Jones.
That's it for normality. We'll let you go back to the geeks. Cheers, folks.
All right. Thanks, guys. Nice job.
At least you guys know what happened to all the DC-9s now. They went to Australia.
Yeah, that's right.
And they don't like them very much.
Jack, did you ever have a close call lining up with the wrong airport or the wrong runway, or did you nail it all the time?
Well, you want the truth, or?
Yeah, sure. I won't tell anybody.
I'll tell you what, on my very first trip as captain, and that meant I had a check captain in the right seat with me on a 727, went from New York, LaGuardia to Tucson, Arizona, with a stop in Albuquerque. And I haven't been to Albuquerque since then, but as I remember back in those days, there were two airports lined up perhaps 4 or 5 miles apart. And seems that the check captain thought I was lined up with the wrong airport. Now, you know, I disagree with that. But we were in rather close by the time I agreed with them and readjusted. So, you know, there are those who have been there and those who will be there. But, no, it can happen.
Yeah.
There's one in El Paso, I think, too, that it happens all the time. There's a military base out there, and it lines up with one of the major runways at the commercial field. And airplanes are always landing at the military field or coming very close to touching down. So it's something that's not all that unusual, unfortunately. It's going to be more so, I think, now, you know, with this technology, the way it's taking us.
Yeah, I remember years ago watching a commercial airliner almost land at Pratt & Whitney's runway outside my office building. And wheels down the whole thing and kind of at the last minute realized that, no, that wasn't Bradley Airport, and pulled up and headed north to the airport.
I think one of the slickest examples of that was I was flying as a passenger on a Northwest flight going into Rapid City, South Dakota. And it was a beautiful, clear night. They were making some nice gentle turns from approaching the airport onto final, and the flaps are coming down, the gear came down, landing lights are on. He's coming down to about the point where you come over the airport property, and you're beginning to see some of the runway threshold lights. And just as gradually as you can imagine and as gently as possible, the thrust starts increasing. This is on a 737. The power starts coming up, and the flaps don't come up. The gear doesn't come up, but we are starting to climb. And we, sure enough, go right over this airport, and I'm looking, and there are B-52s off on the left side. And just as sweet as you can imagine, this guy goes and drags this thing out with the gear down and full flaps for about another 4 or 5 miles until we came to the commercial field.
Rapid
City, and he makes a nice landing. I don't think there was anyone on that aircraft other than myself that knew what really had gone on.
Wow.
But he was lucky.
Yeah, I guess it happens. And
it does.
Sometimes you get the good views.
Well, as long as they're landing on runways, not in the fields, that's okay.
That's right. Okay, now it's time for Peter Johnson across the pond.
Today, we're coming from Barcelona, and we welcome back Jesus Calderon. Jesus, welcome back across the pond.
Hello, Peter. Thank you for having me again.
Thank you very much for taking a time out of a very busy life to talk about aeroplanes. Of course, you're a controller in an air traffic controller in Barcelona. And when we last spoke, there were some changes to the tower and runway procedures at Barca. Have there been any more, and how did these go?
Yes, they're going nicely. I think right now we are using two control towers, as I explained on the last interview, and one bigger one for local control, ground movement, and clearance delivery, and a smaller one next to Terminal 1, only for the ground control of that side of the airport.
Yeah.
This smaller one is also being equipped to be used as a contingency tower. You know, maybe the big one had to be closed or evacuated for any reason. We don't have to shut down the whole airport.
Yeah, okay.
So far everything is going pretty well, and though we are always trying to improve our procedures, you know. As an example, maybe I can explain to you that we have agreed, reached an agreement with EasyJet to put in place a procedure called push and hold, which is that we can give them the startup and clearance and the pushback clearances before the time of their slot time, for example.
Okay.
And then we assign them to taxi and wait in a position which is closer to the departure runway.
Yeah.
So in case that they receive an improvement in their slot time and they can depart earlier, they are closer to the runway. And so we are trying to improve, as always.
Wow, that's really innovative. I've not heard of that before. Is that something unique to Barcelona?
I don't think so. From the airports that I know, we are the only ones doing that.
Yeah.
But I don't think it's something that we have invented. That, in fact, I think it was EasyJet who proposed it to us, and we found it very interesting. And in fact, when they are waiting, they can shut off the engines.
Yeah.
And when we receive the improvement, we always try to receive the improvements on the their slot time about at least 5 to 10 minutes that they can be airborne.
Yeah.
So they have time to start up the engines again and taxi to the runway as the objective is they are closer to the runway.
Now, the last time I tried to get hold of you, you were actually in my part of the world. You were in the UK, and you said you were taking your ATPL exams.
Yeah.
What's going on? Why are you taking your ATPL exams, Jesus?
Well, in fact, Peter, I'm actually following Rob Mark's steps, you know, first being an ATC and then switching to the cockpit. What I'm trying to do is keep active on the piloting world, you know, because since I started controlling, I haven't flown that much.
Yeah.
In part because it's so expensive, you know, and flying without kind of mission, something to do, just to fly over the here over my hometown at 2,500 feet is not that funny at the end. So so far, I've passed communications, human performance, and metrology.
Yeah.
And I am. My plan is to pass all the ATPL subjects with a British Flying Academy based in Coventry near Birmingham.
Yeah.
And then got the multi-engine IFR and flight instructor ratings. I'll probably take the flying lessons here at my home airport.
Yeah.
Because you know I cannot go to the UK to make every flying class.
Yeah.
And then, if possible, I'd like to be a part-time instructor while continuing to work as an ATC. Yeah. To be able to fly without having to pay for that, you know.
Yeah, of course, and that really is following in the steps of Rob. Jesus, now a question I meant to ask. You flew to the UK, and I wanted to ask a controller this for a long time. When you fly on a commercial flight, what goes through your mind, you know, when you get to the airport and you go through the whole process? Are you thinking through the whole control process?
For me, I always try to get a window seat and be aware of what's going on. You know, for example, from which runway are we going to take off, or why they are using this runway or this runway configuration.
Yeah.
If there's some traffic on the holding point, see which is the departure sequence. I don't know, during the approach, see if we have to do some holding patterns or there may be any issues caused by weather, for example, as in air traffic control, weather is always a big disturbance. And in fact, I try to see my job from the other side and try to learn something new, you know, to put me in the place of the pilot or the passenger, and then think of what I'd like the air traffic controller to do to make my trip easier and faster and more comfortable.
Okay, and I think I asked you last time whether you ever got the opportunity to fly jump seats. Is any opportunities like that exist in this day where security is so tight?
Yeah, in fact, we started a visits program with some airlines at Barcelona, like Vueling and like Ryanair.
Yeah.
And the intention was to invite pilots to visit the tower and see our side of the frequency.
Yeah.
And then we also got the opportunity to fly with them on a jump seat and see all the flight, the departure, the approach, the cruising, and see the part of the story.
Now, before I let you go, Jesus, I've got to ask you, in my understanding of aviation in Spain, I've always thought of Madrid being the busy hub. And the worldwide hub. But I saw some numbers that you published recently that said Barcelona had actually handled more traffic than Madrid.
Yeah. In fact, the big news has been because for the first time, Barcelona has beaten Madrid in number of passengers, not in operations, but in number of passengers during the summer season, during this past summer season.
And why is that, Jesus? Is it to do with vacation traffic or is it something else?
Yeah, there's a number of reasons, Peter. As you probably know, Madrid has always been a big hub for Iberia.
Yeah,
with its short and medium range, but in special for its long range routes to the Americas, for example. And with the merging with British Airways, Iberia is flying less transcon routes. And then a huge part of its market has just vanished from then.
I understand.
Yeah. On the other hand, at Barcelona, we're expanding more and more our number of company hubs like Ryanair, EasyJet and in special Vueling, which is continuing to grow at an impressive rate.
Yeah.
And this summer also, I don't know, the Russian market has really made the big numbers at Barcelona, and the number of North Americans flying to Barcelona to visit the city and start a Mediterranean cruise has been as good as always.
Yeah.
And I don't know, finally, I could also mention the nice expansion that the airport is achieving in the Asian Middle East markets also, through airlines like Qatar Airways, Singapore Airlines, and Emirates. In fact, we are very excited because this last one, Emirates, is going to start using the A380 on its daily flight to Dubai from Barcelona, starting now in February.
Wonderful.
So, I will tell you in a future talk how all that goes with the A380.
But Jesus, I know you're very busy. You're just about to leave for some extra shifts. Two things before you go. Firstly, on behalf of all of the Airplane Geeks and listeners, congratulations on the impending birth of your daughter.
Thank you.
Very excited. And secondly, where can we find out about you online?
Sure, Peter. You can find me, as always, in my personal Facebook page. With my name, Jesus Calderon. You can follow me on Twitter at Hardenau, which is HARDENAW.
Wonderful. Hey, Zeus, thank you very much for joining us again.
No problem, Peter. Anytime you know.
This is Peter Johnson reporting for the Airplane Geeks from across the pond.
Ooh, the responsibility of listening to someone say that they're following in my footsteps. Wow. Whew. Hey, Jesus, I hope it goes well for you, bud, between the new baby and the ATPL. But it's really funny when I'm listening to him talk about those familiarization rides, because I remember when I was still a controller, I used to just drool at the opportunity to sit up front and watch those folks fly. And I knew I'd get to do it someday, and it was pretty cool though. I mean, I tell people that are controllers, if you have the opportunity, it is absolutely worth doing.
Very good. All right, we just have a few minutes left. We were going to give a plug for Aviation Geek Fest 2014, but David, that turns out to be kind of not possible.
Actually, we probably can't give a plug for AGF 14, but we could probably give a shout out to AGF 15, which will be the 14th and 15th in Seattle of 2015. Congratulations, David. David Parker Brown is running it. You can find him on Twitter at Airline Reporter. He evidently sold it out in a matter of minutes. He's beginning to think that Aviation Geek Fest is a lot like a major rock concert. If you don't start tapping away at the computer an hour ahead of time, you're not going to get your tickets. As far as we know right now, they still have limited, it's 2 days, but they do have limited single day tickets. So if you're going to be in the Seattle area, definitely look it up. My only plead to David Parker Brown is, will you stop having it on Valentine's Day weekend so some of us can actually maybe venture out there without offending our significant others?
Yeah, either that or we've got to find different wives.
I'm glad you said that. Because
probably easier
to
get him to change Geek Fest, I think. Because I have the same problem. I would like to have gone, but on Valentine's Day, not going to happen.
I mean, it's bad enough we have to work around Father's Day for Be a Pilot Day. So it's, so for 2016, David, could you push it maybe either later in the month or maybe pick another month? Just suggestion.
Yeah, and those guys are going to have a blast this year. They're going to be at the museum, or at the Future Flight Museum, the Everett Delivery Center, even the Dream Lifter Operations Center, and the 737 factory in Renton. They're going to go on a tour of the Boeing factory there. So it's going to be a great time. This is a good reason to plan ahead for next year.
And just another quick shout out to Mart and AirPigs. They're heading to Pensacola this weekend. So if you're in the Florida Panhandle area, you might want to reach out to AirPigs and Mart. He's going to have at least 8 or 9 people. Last year, I went down to the Smithsonian and had a great weekend with the guys. Pensacola is a little bit farther drive than D.C., and besides, this weekend in D.C., I'm going to be hanging out at our favorite museum, the Udvar-Hazy Center, and hanging out in the restoration team to bring you back stuff. So, but yeah, shout out to Park David. Congratulations on the success. I know you work really hard about this all year, but we definitely need to pick a different weekend.
All right, just a couple of quick listener emails. We received several concerning episode 281. Where Victoria, you'll recall, came and talked to us about Women in Aviation Week. And some of our listeners have decided to get involved. If you'd like to go back, if you haven't listened to that, take a look at airplanegeeks.com/281 for our conversation with Victoria. Here's one example. We heard from Aaron, who wrote and said he hadn't heard of this event before, but thanks to your podcast, my oldest daughter, age 7, will be getting her first airplane flight at the event in Seattle at Boeing Field that week. So it's just one example of what this is designed to do. And so if you'd like to get involved, please do. If you have children that you could get involved, consider that as well. We had sort of an anniversary recently, David, that snuck up on me. 5 years since Sully put the plane down in the Hudson, and we heard from several readers about that.
It is kind of amazing that we talked about that as a topic one night on the podcast. Sully was all over the place last week, and it is still amazing watching that video and watching that. But we got a rock video, didn't we, Max?
Yeah, we did. We heard from Zach Sherwin, who says that he is a comedian and a musician from Los Angeles. And he released a music video in honor of Sully's landing, The Miracle on the Hudson. And it's actually a comedic rap ballet. We'll put a link to this in the show notes, too. This is worth taking a look at. Imagine Sully, or someone who looks an awful lot like him, except he's wearing dance tights and definitely has the legs of a dancer, which I'm sure Sully does not. Although, you know, you never know. Performing in this video, so we'll.
Hey, let's watch it. You know, some of these pilots are pretty hot. You know,
yeah.
We work out, we stay in shape.
Okay, all right. Well, you can.
Jack can attest to that.
Check out the video. Make your own determination. Dan also sent an article, a link to an article 5 years later, still feeling impact of plane down in the Hudson, and we'll have a link to that in the show notes as well.
Should we continue the art segment? I think we need to continue our art segment. This has been a very interesting week, folks. We also heard from Bjorn. Evidently, the Munich airport produced a world premiere of the opera This New Ocean, and the cast of the opera were crew members working with Lufthansa, South African Airways, ANA, and S7, as well as the Munich airport staff. So we suddenly now are getting into the arts appreciation segment of the Airplane Geeks.
Yeah, this is kind of interesting. This is definitely different. The new ocean refers to the skies in flying. Now, they have a Facebook page, so you can learn more about that. Just go to facebook.com/thisnewocean, all one word, and you'll find them there.
Links in the show notes.
We had a question from Diogo that I don't know if you guys know the answer. I don't. He asked, what's the name of the startup South American cargo airline that has or will have 12 737-400s and 12 ATR-200 aircraft? He says, as an airline geek, not knowing the information is annoying me. I think you know the feeling. He says, hope we can help out. And I've seen some articles about this, but none of them name this startup South American cargo airline. So if you know, let us know, and we'll pass the word along.
I think it's the NSA.
It's the NSA.
Yeah, it's the NSA. They're down there checking things.
No doubt. And then finally and quickly, we received an email. This is called Close Call is Ice Rain from Sky at Annadel. And this was some ice that fell out of the sky, a rather big chunk of ice. And its origin is not completely clear, but some people suspect that it might have come off of an airplane. Now, I think when we see ice coming off of airplanes, it's usually blue because it's something from the...
Laboratory,
yes. This is white. This particular ice is a chunk of white ice, or at least it's not blue. And there's some speculation that sometimes aircraft accumulate ice from other sources besides the labs, wastewater from the kitchen or something like that. I don't know. Rob or Jack, do you know anything about big chunks of white ice that can fall from airplanes?
Yeah, I've seen it happen coming out of the Northwest, like Seattle and Portland, where you, on a climb out, if you're going to be going through freezing temperatures and it's raining, sometimes you'll pick up a lot of clear ice that begins to break off at higher altitudes and higher speeds. So, you know, it's possible that that may have been, where was this that it occurred? Did they mention?
It is in, well, Annadel, but I don't know where that is.
Mm. I don't either.
Yeah, so I'm not sure.
But it's not an uncommon event in the Northwest, just because of the unique climate conditions up there, but it has happened.
Okay.
I still wouldn't put it in my drink if I were.
No. And if I saw it coming, boy, I'd run away, because this could really take you out if it hit you. All right, so thanks for sending that in. All right, well, that'll do it for this episode of the Airplane Geeks Podcast. We want to thank our guest, Jack Suhaki, for joining us, president of Eyewitness Animations. Jack, again, thank you.
Well, thank you so much for having me on tonight. I really appreciate it. And be sure that I'm going to be listening to your podcast in the future. Very interesting.
Fantastic. And folks want to learn more, go over to eyewitnessanimations.com.
That's with an E, not an I.
That's right.
Absolutely.
Hey, Jack, can I ask you a quick question before you run off about Eyewitness? Did you have a favorite Eyewitness animation that you guys did that you just is up on the site that you say, wow, that was us. That was a great piece of work. I'm just curious.
You know, well, there are a couple that, matter of fact, there are several we can't put up there because of agreements in litigation or court order to keep them under lock. Yes, but it's not up on the site. But if we should have a conversation sometime, on a more private basis, I just might be able to provide a link that you guys can go and look at that.
Cool.
All right. We'll talk about that later.
Okay. Thank you again, guys. I appreciate it. Enjoyed it.
We also want to thank our contributors, Grant McHaren and the crew, minus Steve Vischer from PlaneCrazyDownUnder.com for their Australia Desk Report. Get well, Steve. Also, we want to thank Peter Johnson for his Across the Pond segment. You can find him at aviation-extended.co.uk. No leading.
Can we say thank you to Jesus, just because I always think that that's the best thing, is to say thank you to Jesus?
It usually is. Those two make a good pair, by the way. I like it when he and Peter get together. All right, well, let's tell folks where they can find each of us online. David Vanderhoof, we will start with you.
You can find me on Twitter at DM Vanderhoof. And of course, you can find us every Friday, Max and I, talking about that other subject we love so much, UAVs, on the UAVdigest.com.
And Rob Mark?
Jetwine.com. Jetwine on Twitter. Robert Mark on Facebook and LinkedIn and I don't know where else. And I'll just say thank you to Jesus, too, for joining Peter Johnson, and hey, listen, bud, if you're going to follow in my footsteps, if your daughter turns out as good as mine did, you'll be a lucky guy. So go for it, man.
Oh, that's sweet. And I'm Max Flight. Look for me on Google+ and Twitter as Max Flight. Also, as David mentioned, at theuavdigest.com for that podcast. Also, find me with Mary Kirby over at runwaygirlnetwork.com for the PaxX podcast. That's the Passenger Experience podcast.
So, Max, how does it feel to be a token on that website?
It's great because it's a lot less work than this one. Plus, getting to work with Mary is fantastic. She's brilliant. It's just the depth of her knowledge on the topic is just quite amazing.
Mary, I'm still waiting for you to call me.
Yeah, keep waiting, Rob.
I know.
You can find show notes for this episode at airplanegeeks.com. It'll have links to all the items that we mentioned. If you want to go straight to the post for this episode, you can visit airplanegeeks.com/283. Be sure to follow us on Twitter, Facebook, and Google+. We're also on Stitcher.com, where you can stream us right to your mobile phone, and also find us on TuneIn.com. If you'd like to send us an email, the address is thegeeks@airplanegeeks.com. And, of course, we have a listener line, and for that we'll turn to Aunt Benet.
The Airplane Geeks want to hear from you, so please give them a call at 361-GEEK-01.
Opening and closing music is by Brother Love. Find him at brotherloverocks.com. So join us again next week as we talk aviation on the Airplane Geeks podcast. Bye, everybody.
Thanks Bye-bye. For listening.
And for Rob's benefit, I'm in Southern California, and it's 71 degrees here right now, Rob.
What city are you in?
Irvine.
Oh, my daughter goes to school over at USC.
Oh, so really?
She just texted me a picture from the beach a little while ago. She was studying. She was studying with her friends.
Absolutely.
All right.
You want to talk to her?
Ooh, it's going to be that kind of a show.
If there was only some way we could fact check these things.
Only some device existed.
I just remembered the Americans don't speak meters.
How long would that take you to pace up and down to check meters? He's on fire tonight, he is.
Terrible. Zang.
Terrible.
That's where you live, isn't it, Damien?
Where I used to live.
Oh, I thought you were still there.
No, we moved from Toowoomba about 18 months ago.
But well, am I behind the scene or what?
News travels fast around here.
Ben, have you got any thoughts on that?
No, to be honest with you, I don't.
Steve Vischer, does he still work here?
I don't know. I think he's still drawing a paycheck.
A paycheck? What the hell's that?
Yeah, oh,
a paycheck of $0.
That's yeah, the sorry, guys. Was I not supposed to? I probably shouldn't have mentioned that. Yeah, sorry. anyhow, moving on.
The first thing that the answer to this question, the first question about what we are thinking the air traffic controllers when we board a commercial flight, it's very simple. We always think like, hey, I'm an ATC. Can I be upgraded to first class for free, please?
Oh, yeah. Sorry. Get the priorities right. Yeah.
Yeah. I imagine, in fact, it depends on if the controller is a real geek, you know, like me,
yeah,
or not.
Oh, don't credit Rob.
Like him.
Don't give Rob too much credit. We won't be able to get his head through the door.